At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All those stories about how Google is going to take over the world? Yeah, take one step back on that. Also, Newsweek steps into its digital future, whatever that may be. And our collaboration with Frontline continues, campaign finance and its secrets. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday. It's the 18th of October. Glad to have you with us. The single most important piece of paper in the American capital markets today was a rough draft. A rough draft that was somehow sent to the Securities and Exchange Commission ahead of schedule, Google's draft quarterly profit report. You can tell it's not the final copy because it was hours ahead of schedule and because there was a placeholder in it, a little piece of text that says, "pending Larry quote," as in Google CEO Larry Page and his words of wisdom. Adding insult to injury here, the financial contents of the thing were as shocking as the format slip-up, Marketplace's Eve Troe reports.
Google's plan was to wait until the stock market closed for the day to report a 20% decline in profits. But since its quarterly report was filed with the SEC early, while the stock market was still open, the company's stock fell about 9% before trading was suspended.
No one's enjoying this.
Ben Schachter follows Google for Macquarie Securities.
The big surprise is there's probably about $200 million plus of costs that we did not expect.
Costs like data centers, he says. As people use the internet more often in more places, thanks to smartphones, Google has to buy more and more data routing gear and pay for the electricity to run it. And although smartphones, advertisers won't pay as much for ads on them, says Colin Gillis at stockbroker BCG Partners.
They're worth about 50 cents on a dollar compared to a traditional wired internet.
That harkens back to an old-school print ad way of thinking. Advertisers don't see why they should pay the same amount for a teeny ad on your tiny phone screen as they would for one that shows up much bigger on your laptop. Roger Kay at Endpoint Technologies says Google suffered because of that.
They haven't been able to convince people to pay more for what amounts to a smaller ad.
Even though the ads on a mobile phone are smaller, they cost Google just as much on the back end, in data servers, power, and personnel, to get them there. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
And then there was one Newsweekly left standing as a print publication. This morning, Tina Brown, the editor-in-chief of Newsweek Daily Beast, said Newsweek, the actual hard copy magazine, is on its way out of here. Last print edition is New Year's Eve. After that, it's going to be digital only. We've called media critic Jeff Jarvis, himself a strong proponent of the move to digital journalism, to get his thoughts on this whole thing. Jeff, it's good to have you back.
Thank you, Kai.
So is this just another march toward the overhaul of journalism as we know it? What do you think?
Overhaul is a nice way to put that, Kai, yes. I actually hope so. I think that this is a march toward digital, which is inevitable, and we're going to get there. And the problem here is that print is becoming increasingly unsustainable, and general interest magazines just plain are unsustainable.
Tina Brown said this morning in her statement that we are going to transition to a subscription-based digital-only Newsweek. Is there a market for that out there, that people are going to pay for this online stuff?
I don't think so. You know, I get accused of hating paywalls, but I will happily sell you my books and my Kindle single. So I'm not against charging for content, but we're in a world of abundance now. So I don't think there's a lot of chance that a magazine that was not succeeding is now going to succeed digitally. Yes, the costs will be lower, but I don't see a huge strategy for an online demand to go get Newsweek.
We had Barry Diller on the show a couple of weeks ago. He, of course, runs IAC, which is the company that owns the Daily Beast and Newsweek. And I asked him about a lot of things, actually. It was a good interview. But one of the things I asked him was about losing money as a way to shake things up, right? And here's the question and part of his answer. I ask because of your investment in the Daily Beast and Newsweek, which is, you know, the fading Newsweekly and all that.
Oh, yes, it is.
Oh, yes, it is, he said, right? And then we went back and forth, and then he said this specifically about Newsweek.
Now, at a certain point, as we've done in some things, where we've said, well, we've invested $90 million in this, and it hasn't worked out for us. Sell it. Write it off. Go on to the next thing. Absolutely.
Nobody ought to be surprised, right, Jeff Jarvis, that this was
not at all, because he's talked about needing to have a new plan for Newsweek. Who can afford to lose $30 to $40 million on this thing? Rupert Murdoch loses reportedly about that much in the New York Post because he wants a bully pulpit here.
Yeah.
But Barry Diller doesn't, and we already have the internet. He has other media properties. You know, and the truth is, Kai, I think that the last-ditch effort to save Newsweek on the newsstand led to some pretty horrible journalism. The Muslim Rage cover was awful.
Yeah.
The Heaven is Real cover is a parody of Newsweeklies for the last couple decades. I think that Newsweek online may be journalistically better than it was in its last days in print.
Why not just embrace Daily Beast in toto and kill off Newsweek? Why sort of do this thing where it's going to live online?
I think there's some face-saving here. Daily Beast was growing and efficient, and then it came along and said, ooh, we can get this venerable old brand, and a lot of Barry Diller's money has gone into the crapper from this. Barry Diller is not a terribly romantic guy, but I'll bet he said, okay, Tina, go ahead, give it a shot.
I realize that I'm totally asking the wrong guy on this question, but does this make you sad at all, or is it false romanticism?
I think it's false romanticism, Kai. It makes me sad for the people who are losing their jobs, most certainly. But I celebrate transitioning to the digital world. Newsweek may or may not make it, but what this does is say more and more and more that news and media are going to live digitally. That's where we have to go. So the more we push other properties to go digital before it's too late, before they start losing $20, $30, $40 million a year, the better off we're going to be in journalism. And I really believe that.
Jeff Jarvis blogs at buzzmachine.com. He is the director for the Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the City University of New York. Jeff, thanks a lot for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
Google shares eventually started trading again today. Finished things off about 8%. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've got a collaboration going with Frontline this month. It's a special investigation into campaign finance. Specifically, how did the Supreme Court's ruling in Citizens United a couple of years ago, which said labor unions and corporations could spend essentially as much as they wanted on politics, how has that changed our campaigns? Lots of ways, obviously. Maybe the biggest is that what's happening this election cycle is being driven by more money than ever before. The money is being spent by campaigns, yes, and parties, super PACs, of course. Also, groups that are known simply as 501c4s. They're named after a section of the tax code, actually, if you're curious. But the big difference between them and super PACs is that the 501c4s don't have to tell anybody where they're getting their money, and they can spend as much as they want, as long as that spending is independent of campaigns and candidates. It's a long way of saying that the upshot of the whole thing is that this year, secret money is buying tens of millions of dollars worth of ad time. And all that secrecy makes some people uneasy. But why? Marketplace's Mark Garrison got that assignment.
Kai's question is tricky because it's so rarely asked. There are fierce arguments about campaign finance, of course, but they're largely about who can give and how much. You don't hear many people publicly sticking up for secret donations. Mostly you hear from groups fighting against secrecy, like Democracy 21, led by Fred Wertheimer. What's his problem with secrecy?
Secret money spent in elections leads to corruption and scandal.
Try to argue against that, and you're siding with sinister-sounding things, secrecy, anonymity, dark money. And your opponent stands with open government, sunshine laws, transparency. The very language of the debate is arrayed against you before the facts are even presented. But some do make the counterargument, like John Samples of the Libertarian Cato Institute. Ask him about anonymous donations, and he doesn't use the word secret.
I think they're private in the sense that people have a right to be free of sort of undue harassment.
To him, donations are private, not secret. Disclosing campaign giving draws a roadmap for people in power to retaliate against those who gave to other candidates. Keep in mind, nobody questions your right to keep your vote private. For Samples, the check you write to a politician is as private as the check mark you make behind the drawn curtain of a voting booth. If you think of political donations as private instead of secret, they don't sound so obviously diabolic.
But they didn't provide a head-to-head.
I wanted insight into why secret donations are such a problem for so many people, so I tapped a couple of psychologists, starting in Professor Anita Kelly's Notre Dame classroom. She specializes in information people hide from each other.
Keeping a secret can and often does violate expectations for honest communication in a relationship.
Kelly doesn't focus on politics, but NYU psychologist Eric Knowles does. He says some secrecy is understandable, such as information withheld for national security reasons. It all depends on credibility.
When people have a generally positive impression of somebody, they can tolerate that person keeping secrets.
He says it seems secret donations trouble our mind in a way other secrets don't, because we don't trust political operatives.
If somebody's already seen as sort of a wheeler dealer, then secrecy has a very different connotation.
And the current campaign finance system is quite a playground for wheeler dealers. I put the question of secret donations to Tufts University political philosopher Lionel McPherson. He first told me he thought donors could stay private as long as groups buying political ads provide information about their leaders and agenda.
That wouldn't require that we know everybody who has contributed to help make the ad possible.
But this is a guy who thinks deeply for a living, so after more reflection, McPherson offered a slightly different view based on magnitude.
There's a big difference between giving $50 or $100 and giving $5 million. A person who's giving $5 million, even if it's that person's legal right, seems to me that they no longer have a claim to privacy. They're no longer really operating as a typical equal citizen.
So this is the point in most campaign finance stories where either the badness of a bad guy is declared or the reporter proclaims both sides had their say and the truth lies somewhere in the middle. Sorry to disappoint. The issue of secret donations is a lot more complex. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
If you want a primer on Citizens United, we've got one. It's from our friends at the Center for Public Integrity. It's online at marketplace.org. And there's a radio story coming every week this month about Citizens United and campaign finance. It's all part of that collaboration we're doing with Frontline. Comes to a head with a television documentary at the end of the month. It's called Big Sky, Big Money, about some of the surprising secrets of political money this election season. Mark your calendars. October 30th, me on television. Check it out. Coming up, optimism in the face of bankruptcy.
I realized, okay, from the time I was born, I believed I had a destiny in something, but I didn't know what it was.
Turns out, it's chickens. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial slipped 8 points today, less than a 10%, closed at 13,548. The NASDAQ clicked down 31 points, 1%, 3,072. The S&P gave back 3 points, 0.25%. Finished at 1457. As we mentioned earlier, Google showed its hand a little early today with the accidental release of its earnings report. The company at fault for that, R.R. Donnelley, it's a financial printing house, actually, lost 0.9%. Abbott Laboratories shot down 3.5% today. Pharmaceutical giant had to cancel late-stage testing on a drug for chronic kidney disease and diabetes. eBay bid up 5% higher today. PayPal had a nice jump in revenue. Bond prices slipped. The yield on the 10-year T-note crept up to 1.83%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up tomorrow. A look at the health of the housing market. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for September. How many meals are Happy Meals? McDonald's releases quarterly earnings. And it's the 25-year anniversary of Black Monday. Investors suffered a serious setback when the Dow Jones plummeted 508 points, more than 22% in value. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Don't look now, but we've got another rich guy with a super PAC to tell you about. The mayor of New York City, Mike Bloomberg, said he's going to take as much as $15 million from his personal fortune, which is much larger than that, and use it to support moderate candidates in House and Senate races. It's by no means the first time the mayor has used his wealth to influence politics and policy far beyond New York City. Dan Bobkoff has more now on the Bloomberg economy.
There are many things Mayor Bloomberg doesn't like. Guns, smoking, and big sodas, to name just a few. As mayor, he's worked to reduce all three, but he's clearly not content just to change things here. Kenneth Sherrill is a political science professor at Hunter College.
He puts his money where his mouth is, and he uses his money to make sure that his mouth gets heard wherever he wants.
Forbes magazine says Bloomberg's net worth is a cool $25 billion. Sherrill says combine that with the bully pulpit of leading the nation's biggest city, and you have some outsized influence.
To use his power as mayor to multiply the power of his wealth in politics.
Take tobacco. After implementing smoking bans in restaurants in New York, the philanthropy he founded poured $375 million into similar efforts beyond the city. Those dollars went to organizations like the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. Matthew Myers is its president, and he says the mayor's power can be seen as far away as Turkey, which banned smoking in many indoor places.
Turkey acted only after looking at the experience in New York City and with financial support from Bloomberg Philanthropy.
Which is why Cheryl of Hunter College asks,
would you think of somebody else who's combined those two things in this way?
And with his new super PAC, Mayor Bloomberg is banking he can have the same influence in this election season. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
You can love tomatoes or you can hate them, but you gotta respect them. Not just for the lycopenes, but because they could soon affect the global economy. Tomato growers in Florida have been pressing the Obama administration to end a 16-year-old tomato agreement with Mexico, which the White House has tentatively agreed to do. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler looks at what could be the makings of a trade war.
At this warehouse in central Florida, the packing machinery gets a test before the season starts next week. Tony DeMare is a third-generation tomato farmer. He hopes this season is better than the last.
As a result of last year's total devastation in the marketplace, we have lost three major tomato producers in the state of Florida. Our industry is shrinking, and the Mexican industry seems to be growing.
He blames Mexican growers for selling tomatoes in the U.S. for less than it costs to produce them. That practice is known as dumping. Florida farmers have accused Mexico of dumping before, back in 1996. The two countries reached an agreement where Mexican farmers won't sell tomatoes in this country below a certain price. DeMare thinks the agreement is outdated.
We're asking to do away with the agreement. You'll have an open border of completely unrestricted free trade.
That kind of talk worries U.S. beef, pork, and chicken producers. They've been victims of retaliation in past trade disputes with Mexico. So their anxiety is almost like something out of the movie Attack of the Killer Tomatoes.
Even the mere mention of the word is sufficient to induce panic.
Tomato.
Rather than panic, Mexican farmers are suspicious. They suspect election year pandering and say they've heard it all before from Florida farmers.
This is not something that started last week. They have been in opposition of free market in tomatoes against Mexico since the 1800s.
Martin Lay grows around 22 million pounds of tomatoes a year in Mexico and ships them to the U.S. and Canada. He's in Washington, D.C. this week representing Mexican farmers in negotiations with the Commerce Department. Lay says his company produces cheaper tomatoes because it has adapted to the marketplace.
We have innovated into new varieties and into new tomato types in the marketplace by giving a tomato that is very flavorful, that is very attractive, that smells really good.
Lay worries that the U.S. will slap Mexican tomatoes with a new tariff, which could spark an all-out trade war. But Reggie Brown with the Florida Growers Exchange says the U.S. won't be responsible.
If there is any threat of war, it is based upon the retaliation threats that have been hurled by the Mexican industry and the Mexican government.
Mexico has struck back in the past. That's why some U.S. companies and even Walmart have sided with the Mexican growers. American businesses don't want a tomato trade war to eat into their revenues. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
If it's not prying, could I ask how much you trust online reviews of a restaurant or a barbershop or anything else for that matter? Well, if you trust them a lot, this next story is for you. Yelp, the online review site, said today it's going to start putting out alerts on its web pages that read, "We caught somebody red-handed trying to buy reviews for this business." Marketplace's Quina Kim has the cautionary tale.
Weeding out fake or purchased reviews isn't new to Yelp. The site has an algorithm that monitors its 30 million reviews regularly. It sweeps out bad reviews and highlights trusty ones. Vince Salito is the head of public affairs at Yelp.
And as a result, we display about 80% of the reviews that are submitted to our site to protect consumers from fake and shill review content.
That means 20% of the reviews submitted to Yelp aren't posted because, for the most part, they're fake or paid for. But recently, Yelp's team of crack investigators took its sleuthing to the real world.
We noticed some advertisements on places like Craigslist and elsewhere where business owners were offering to pay money in exchange for people to write them positive reviews.
And so Yelp employees posed as elite reviewers and answered the job listings. The status of elite reviewer is awarded to people who've done lots of reviews.
And we saw that some business owners were willing to pay large sums of money, especially for reviews written by elite folks.
Yelp caught more than a dozen companies in the sting. They included a moving company and a jewelry store. And now those businesses have a warning label saying they've been caught red-handed. Bing Liu is a professor of computer science at the University of Illinois in Chicago. He researches fake reviews. So you think it's going to work?
Yeah, I think it's going to work. It makes the store very, very careful.
Because stores know that if their reviews are exposed as fakes, customers won't shop there. I'm Quina Kim for Marketplace.
When a city goes broke, a lot of things happen. Services get cut, fingers get pointed, the list of problems gets bigger, easy solutions get harder to come by. San Bernardino, California, in the desert, about an hour east of Los Angeles, filed for bankruptcy this summer. And over the past couple of weeks, we've been spending time out there trying to figure out how a city comes back from that. We've looked at government and crime, infrastructure as well. Today, The Entrepreneur, as David Weinberg wraps up his series.
Albert Okura has always been obsessed with McDonald's, especially the story of how Ray Kroc turned the Golden Arches into the number one corporate symbol in the world. Kroc's story inspired Okura to start his own fast food rotisserie chicken restaurant called Juan Pollo. In 1986, Okura came to San Bernardino to open his second location.
And same year, a book comes out called Behind the Arches by John Love. And it was a story of the McDonald's Corporation. First chapter says, yes, there was the McDonald brothers, and they were in San Bernardino.
So Okura drove over to 14th and E Street to the site of the very first McDonald's.
And I went there and looked at it and said, yeah, then nothing there. And that street was all kind of depressed, like same as it is now. And so I let it go.
6 years later, he came across an article about that very property.
I happened to read the Sunday paper, and it says, history for sale. Site of the original McDonald's for sale, nobody wants it. And it was $135,000.
Okura bought the property, took the boards off the windows and opened an unofficial McDonald's museum.
I'm piggybacking on their brand name, and they can't sue me, because if you look up Google anything San Bernardino or look at McDonald's, my name pops up and then my company pops up, you know. And so that's part of this destiny.
There's one more thing you should know about Albert Okura. He's a man of destiny.
That was my destiny to be the Chicken Man.
When did you realize that it was your destiny to be the Chicken Man?
I realized, okay, from the time I was born, I believed I had a destiny in something, but I didn't know what it was. And it took me till I was about 35 years old when I realized what that destiny was.
Okura, now 60, believes it's his destiny to sell more chicken than anyone else on the planet. And he's off to a decent start. He now operates 32 Juan Pollos in and around San Bernardino.
I'm the foremost expert on rotisserie chicken.
He's also one of the only people I met in San Bernardino who is not angry about the bankruptcy. He said he doesn't expect City Hall to help him or his business in any way.
I learned the business to go with the flow. That's why a lot of people ask me about who am I voting for. I don't vote. I haven't voted in I don't know how many years, 30 years. Because if I take a position on anything, then half the people are going to hate you.
Even now, after the bankruptcy, Okura believes San Bernardino was the perfect place to launch his career. After all, it's the city that created McDonald's and Taco Bell and launched the careers of those chains' founders, Ray Kroc and Glenn Bell.
I'm so happy I'm here because I could stand out.
But at the same time, Okura recognizes the limits of San Bernardino.
People that have potential to really help me in movers and shakers, they've long gone to town.
That's why Okura is looking to expand beyond San Bernardino to India and China. He's working on a computer-controlled rotisserie cooker that will replace the ones he uses today. The cookers he uses today, he bought them from McDonald's, which acquired the machines from Boston Market after they filed for bankruptcy in 2000. Once the new rotisseries are up and running, Okura says he will be one step closer to fulfilling his destiny. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
We've got all of David's reports from San Bernardino and some great pictures he took while he was out there as well. They're online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today. You know those projects that set out to record videos or still pictures from all over the world on the same day? Well, the luxury goods company Montblanc, they do watches besides pens, and so they want to do those same-day photo projects one better. They've got a new thing called World Second. They're going to get people to take pictures all over the world at, yes, the same second. How are they going to do that, you ask? Well, there's an app for that. Montblanc's not saying exactly yet which second it's going to be, but the app, coming soon for Androids and iPhones, will count everybody who has it down to zero and then take a picture automatically. I thought that was kind of cool. All right, we're done. That's it. Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow slipped 8 points, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ off 31 points, 1%. You can thank Google for that. The S&P 500 gave back 3 points, 0.25%. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow, same time, same place. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.